Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Andreas Exertus. Before I bring him on, just a couple of announcements. You can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Rockfin is where you get our premium content you can't find anywhere else. You can also get all the regular shows. Best of all, you get all the content from every creator on Rockfin. Also, check out the podcasts we feature on the Forbidden Knowledge Network. You get those on our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. Follow us on Facebook. Those links are all in the description. And guys, right now would be an amazing time to invest in an emergency food supply. Check out the experts in emergency preparedness, My Patriot Supply. Right now, if you click that link in the description, you can get up to $100 off a four-week supply of their delicious food. Stays good in storage for up to 25 years. Like I said, they're experts in emergency preparedness. Click that link in the description. See what they can do for you. Today, I want to welcome back to the show Andreas Exertus. He is an encyclopedia of conspiracies. Since the age of 11, he was working in Silicon Valley cleaning analog to digital recordings. He is a nanotechnology metamaterial scientist, and he did graphene and stoichiometric indexing at NASA, as well as social media strategy at CNN. He also worked for the Peruvian government in the Amazon for bioremediation of pollution. Andreas, welcome back. How you doing?
Hey, buddy. How's it been?
It's been very good, and happy new year. And yes. Welcome to the fourth ever Conspiracy Buffet episode. This is where we're going to get your thoughts and insights into not only the classic conspiracies that we all know and love, but maybe some new ones that haven't been discussed much. But we really need to get these out because we all know conspiracies are now an endangered species. Since 2020, many have just been proven true, and they're just, you know, not conspiracies anymore. They're just truth. So it's going to be a good time either way. But you were aware of many hidden aspects of the true nature of our reality since a very young age, right?
Well, yeah, I feel like most of my life, things weren't taught to me as secrets, or maybe they were, but I was thinking yesterday that I was raised in a place where 2 + 2 could equal 4, as long as we knew it was just within this room. You know, that's kind of the metaphor for it. I was able to know things that make science kind of make sense, because the way they explain things to people outside, I'm always surprised. People say, oh, well, we descend from monkeys, you believe, or something, you believe in evolution. I'm like, well, that's not what they teach about it in school. Or, oh, you think that the moon is beyond, or the atmosphere or something. Like, well, for 20 years, they were telling me the moon's within the atmosphere. So already all the little things that people have been arguing over, it's just because they haven't had the most updated piece of information. And everything that people believe 10 years ago is proven false. Everything 20 years ago is completely absurd. So now we're at a point where everything is also postmodern, and you can believe whatever you want, but that's right as we're starting to hear a lot of truth. So I feel like I was lucky enough to hear some of those things. And kind of like you, I'm able to formulate ideas based on, I can see a lie and understand a little bit about what it's really about.
Yeah, right. And we live in super, super interesting times, don't we, man? It's pretty crazy what we get to witness during our lifetime. Let's start with, what is your favorite conspiracy, whether it be classic or something we might not have heard?
I kind of think my favorite conspiracy right now, and it's been something I've been thinking about for a few years, and maybe at very least just want to blow this up and have people think about it more, is the idea that the princes, like Prince Harry and Prince Andrew, are both, and also Prince William perhaps, are connected to an art syndicate. Basically, it's the idea that Banksy is created by the royal family. So a lot of people talk about Banksy as this graffiti artist who's able to do a piece in Chernobyl. You know, I mean, how do you get to go to Disneyland, Chernobyl, the Vatican, put up an art piece? How do you get to take apart in Britain, in London, where there's all these security cameras, and weld back together a phone booth and install it? How do you make your art worth so much money? And there's a number of kind of ideas about this, but one of the ones that when I was in 2008, I was in Oakland and Prince William was there with his girlfriend. And then a few days later, Prince Harry said that he was Banksy. But while I was in Oakland, that was while Banksy was in Oakland and he was doing the Exit Through the Gift Shop documentary, which is at a house. At one point, there's a scene where they're going through the Vulcan Warehouse District in Oakland where I lived. So I'd seen that Banksy was supposed to be there, but I didn't meet him. And I'm wondering, like, who's, you know, what's the big deal? People had been talking about DJ Goldie and Goldie being related to Banksy somehow. I've seen a lot of pictures of Goldie with Prince William and Prince Harry. And eventually at Montclair magazine, and we talked about this in the Institute, there was a, I think it was the birthday of the Queen Mother, so the mother of the Queen, and William went to the birthday and he spoke in front of everyone and said, a lot of people don't know that I'm interested in the arts. Actually, I'm Banksy. And it was like sort of a ha 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 moment for everybody. But it was right after I'd just been on my own thinking this weird thought of if they were connected. So over the years, I've been, and that's like 2009. So I've been kind of following the scenario. And I think it makes the most sense if you start to see how the royal family has been abdicating throne or even talking about, you know, their other duties or saying if anyone gets rid of their job for mental health reasons. And there's also a movie called Anonymous, which is about Shakespeare and how Shakespeare was probably written by Sir Francis Bacon, but also by Lord Elwell, I think. One of the other royals that was not supposed to be writing, because the Puritans had said you're not supposed to be doing labor, and this is a labor. So, but also politically, publishing things like Shakespeare wrote things that would have got a royal family member in a lot of trouble. So, or at least published things from earlier plays from Holland or from, you know, the Arab Caliphate that had been translated through Holland that eventually ended up in Britain. Or from France to Britain. These stories, some of them were very, very old. Who would have known these, you know, in these antique myths from other cultures? Who would have been able to read these other languages or been told by someone who could in a study? So the idea that, oh, wait, Shakespeare, this actor who was supposedly pretty much illiterate, right, didn't create the Queen's tongue, you know, is kind of the, people have been wondering about that for a long time. Shakespeare is kind of the same scenario as Banksy. So I kind of think that's kind of interesting. What about you, though?
About the Shakespeare, for those that really aren't familiar with that whole type of conspiracy thing, talk a little bit about that, because that is super interesting, too.
Oh, man, everything about Shakespeare's weird. The Globe stage. The idea of all of these stories being published when they were for political gain is really interesting. When you look at the politics around movies coming out, it's the same thing, right? You'll hear something like this, "Don't Look Up," right as we're looking towards another lockdown.
Yeah.
Because they're saying, oh, okay, there's this metaphor of this thing you can't see coming towards you. You know, and it could have been made for, you know, global warming or climate change, but it's also, it's another entendre because they're telling you in this scenario that nothing's happening. The media is not making a sensation about it and that the people aren't worried about it, which is, and a lot of people believe that that's what the world's like right now. I mean, it's the exact opposite of that problem. We have people that are overinflating and saturating us with these stories that there are cats in trees, right? Before COVID, you know, so the idea that we're not like sensationalizing everything is nonsense. But Shakespeare, it's the same situation. At the time you had a transition of power from the royal family. So for one thing, in the 1600s, there's a fire of London in 1666 and burns down most of London. And so much of the culture is transitioned from the libertine into the Puritan. And there already is sort of a puritanical movement because the king had left his wife and married other women and had five wives and was trying, the whole system had collapsed to the point that no one trusted the final heir of the throne, King Charles. And so Charles was murdered. And then he was decapitated. And then he was replaced by a sort of president. So for a little while there, Britain had basically a president. And they called him the Lord Protectorate. But there was no king, you know. And the king's son survived, but he lived in Amsterdam. I mean, he was just smoking pot and calming down and living peacefully. I mean, really, like Charles II was, from all intents and purposes, pretty chill. but he was off doing his own thing. The puritanical government under Cromwell's Lord Protectorate, really, it's not really presidents, Lord Protectorate, but Protectorate's basically the same concept. He said the laws will be based on democracy. Well, democracy had intersectional levels that were saying, hey, do you see what they're doing? We see what they're doing. We're going to say we have to make an equalization platform that removes rights from and privileges from both of us. So that because we don't need that one. And so the others will lose something. And eventually people lost most of their rights and privileges to the point that England was unfun to live in for most people. And they went and they found the king, well, the prince of England, and they said in Amsterdam, and they said, please, Charles II, come back, please. And he's like, I don't want to. But they're like, you have to come back. It's that bad. Look, we'll make you king. He's like, I don't even want to be king. I mean, don't you guys have a democracy? And like, we don't like it. We're sorry. It was a bad idea. Like, how about this? Instead, you will just be king and you'll protect our right to self-determination. We'll trade up democracy for self-determination. We'll have some representative parliament still, which is what was fine, because then that guy can check with you and make sure. And so eventually they got Charles II to come back from Amsterdam and run England. But then they also started sending people like Puritans out because they were like so tired of people being against art. The cult nature of the Puritans was twofold. One was, hey, look around you. There's all these debauched people that are doing terrible things. But at the same time, they're also saying, hey, you have to do this weird group activity. If you don't go on Sunday to our church, and if God help you, if you're working, like, we'll torture you. So they weren't very popular. And so they were sent to Lytle. And Lytle is a place in Holland where everyone was allowed to do whatever they wanted, really. But the problem with that is, you know, they didn't want to see other people sinning, you know, eating cinnamon and sugar cane and whatever. So eventually they wanted to leave too, which is partially how the United States exists, is because, not completely, but this is the story you hear a lot about, is the idea of the Virginia Company. They were taking people that were part of the settlement from Plymouth because, you know, there were people that wanted to escape Lytle so they could have less freedom. And so America's built somewhat, I mean, at least the aspect of that story where we say people come from the Mayflower, like the Mayflower compass, this is built on a group of people that wanted less freedom for people because they wanted to make sure that no one was allowed to do anything outside of their jurisdiction. But Shakespeare had been already this idea in England that there is a way of speaking, that there's a Star Warsian hierarchy, that is to say, like, some of the most important characters are the lowest characters. There are people that play in Shakespeare plays in the crowd, and then they're looking around like fake news, right? And they're telling people what's going on. And it seems like they're audience, but they're playing audience. So there's so much saturation to what a Shakespearean experience is. It's not just the Ayurvedic style of like Hindu plays where you say, hi, I am the genie, or I'm the prince, and let me tell you a story about another prince and his queen. And, you know, like, there's a way that plays used to be before Shakespeare. They have some of those aspects, like in Fair Verona, where we lay our scene. So you can see if these are based on ancient Vedic plays, but have been spun in a way that are, you know, you've got social realism, which at the time, everything had to be about the elite. So the fact that they have these plays that do focus on the impoverished characters often around the elite, that's very unique. And the most of the time when it's talking about the royal families, you know, it's just when the play is about King Lear or something, then you know, okay, they're making fun of the current king or prince of Wales or something. So the context is very much like Monty Python. Also, you know, if you know, Monty Python is a British series that's really confusing if you watch it without context. But if you find out what was going on that week in the newspapers, then all of a sudden the episode is like South Park. It's about something. And so they're making fun of something. It seems completely absurd if you don't know that the parliament is collapsing one of the ministries this month. And so We're looking at all of these silly, the minister of silly walks. Well, because there's too many ministries, you know, why there is a logic to these stories, but it's kind of hidden.
Right. Yeah. And then a lot of people don't realize that when they're not looking at the big picture of these things, man, that's so interesting. kind of sticking with the royal families, but going back to some more common conspiracies. Royal families, are they lizard people? Are they from an ancient bloodline of aliens? What do you think?
Muted. I was muted. Well, the royal family like to say that they are draconian. And I think most important, this is one of those things where it's the Alex Jones, well, the old Alex Jones before he was David Icke, you know, kind of. We would say, hey, there's two versions of this story. There's the one that's the David Icke where we think everything is supernatural. And there's the other, which is the more practical level. Both of those things are fair. On one level, you have, at very least, superficially, if we were to walk into Bohemian Grove, a group of people that dress up, and then there's some people that are at the center of that, that truly believe that they have some sort of techno marketing magic, and that marketing magic is important. Some of them believe even more, like the royal family, that they have to breed with other members of the royal family because they're connected to something. So at least they believe it, and they run the world. You know, they have money, so they have power. So there's something interesting just about that. You don't even need to go with them on the journey of believing it to see what they're up to. But at the same time, we all seem to have these supernatural connections. I think spirituality and radio are definitely connected. This is something in the 1800s, everyone was looking at paranormal and they were seeing, you know, the inventor of the television and a lot of things that Nikola Tesla was interested in. We're all about the paranormal. I do think that they are that the paranormal is a highly influential part of reality, and that most of what we're experiencing right now, not just the internet itself, but what the radio waves are doing to our Schumann resonance, those things matter. So the idea that there are specific conduits in DNA, like these quantum computers that are wirelessly connected together, that can hit certain vibrations. People have talked about certain kinds of drugs that attach to certain kinds of spirits because there's certain kinds of crystalline and they make certain vibrational antenna resonance. It could be as simple as that, but also that genetically certain blood sequences are quantum computers and that they are picking up on these signals. John C. Lilly talks a lot about, you know, the Echo the Dolphin, which SETI started out as the Order of the Dolphin because they were working on how to echolocate in the dream realm by both mind controlling dolphins and wet wiring the dolphins like Johnny Mnemonic. There's so much of an effort to see beyond the veil and have a war with Dimension X that it seems to me at least the most important thing is that the people with the most money and the most ambition towards realizing their dreams believe that strongly.
Right on. And while we're talking about that, what about the I don't even want to say conspiracy, but the thought that some of these, you know, Silicon Valley elites and you know, technocrats are trying to, like Jordy Rose says, summon the old ones and get in touch with some of these entities on the other side and maybe bring some of these Lovecraftian old boys back and have a party with them or something.
Absolutely. I mean, so in Oakland, actually, I think it was in Richmond, there was a military base where they had a giant redwood and jetpacks. And the idea of bringing smoke vapors to manifest within this area on a crucifix, this giant slug demon thing. There's so many of these people have these. And at Burning Man, you hear more crazy stories about Google and Alex. Jeff Bezos, I think, actually is supposed to be involved in some of the cool. He doesn't listen to music, apparently. And someone made the correlation that this is why, because some of the music, a lot of music has demons, according to the occult. They put the moon single, right? So they have a record that they play the single on in the 70s. This was big, and they'd shine light on the record while they had like an occult group around it without microphones, sort of just talking these weird rituals. And then that goes into like a lower recording that's very hard to pick up, but you can find in some records using certain algorithms, and they're starting to pick up like, oh, okay, this record's been put out by Crosby, Stills and Nash or Chicago. It's not just backwards. It just has a weird subtle level, but it's hard to hear because there's actually like other things going on. It's also like that movie, The Arrival, with Charlie Sheen, where they're hiding the communication comms behind the Mexican music because it has so much dynamic tonality. I think in general, Silicon Valley is full of techno magicians, people that believe the craft. And, you know, this is also Freemasonry kind of talks about, well, hey, there's a practical level in any video game you play where you have a spell. There's these potions and things. There's like ingredients and there's a way to do things. So people that naturally are crafty start to get into sometimes this idea of the occult. And when you're wealthy, one of the things you want to do is you want to put on a ritual, not just a ritual. You want to finance, you want to adopt a prophecy. So you find something that you hear is coming and you do something that day. Wouldn't it be neat if on the eclipse of this day, right? Like Joan Quigley was the astrologer for Reagan and would only do certain kinds of meetings. Any meeting would schedule, like this, for instance, the Reykjavik nuclear summit. Oh, well, that'll be great because we can do that when Pluto and Capricorn are in this eclipse and it'll be good for, I mean, everything is decided that way, mainly because in celestial bureaucracy, the elite are able to say, hey, look, I predict the weather. And shouldn't I be in charge of that? That's been a huge thing in China for thousands of years. If you can control the weather, then all the easier to predict it.
Yeah, man, that's so interesting. You're touching on some of the occult aspects I want to get into, especially when we look at Hollywood. And you mentioned the music industry, how maybe, you know, it's been somewhat weaponized, or there's some kind of satanic aspect to it. You know, I know that you've kind of witness firsthand some of these types of circles. Tell us a little bit about your insights into what's going on with this.
I mean, it seems so general to say, but you look at Burning Man and you start to see how mass media works. There's laugh tracks are going away because they're not necessary anymore. We now know how to control people on a level, or well, the media has made enough studies on people, and we have these Nielsen ratings from Facebook and everything else already, that they can pretty well decide to make an audience react a certain way, and people that don't act that way react the other way. So there's like dynamic reaction. And more, it makes it easy for training people to have post-Lacanian language. Right now, all of our language is based on our experiences and our meta tags of those experiences and my tonality, because I've heard other people scream or cry, or I can use those kinds of energies to explain what I'm saying. But if I took away language and all I had were experiences and I gave you my experiences, it wouldn't necessarily be the same, right? Elon Musk said recently, let's say you're an exhibitionist who wants to share a sexual experience with someone else, right? I would just implant my memory because I'm an extrovert, right? And you could experience the memory in your own body. The problem with that is I could probably, not everyone, but I could probably write a better story about a sexual experience than the experience itself. And who's to say that if you had the experience, that it would be the same experience, because the way you experience it might be different. So we have to learn how to form harmonized installed data points. This is what television, I think, first was for, because that way you have so many people that say, did you experience this? And did you laugh? Or did you cry? Or did you have the same emoji experience back? And the more you can universalize and harmonize and uniformly harmonize the experience, you can synchronize the response. And it doesn't have to be all one way. In fact, which flavor of, you know, a product is the best? No, having four flavors is the best product. You want to have diversity, the illusion of choice. And so at least people can feel like they're making choices, but also you want to have a caste system. It's stereotypical in any civilization that eventually you have a caste system emerge. It's because meritocracy, even through merit, eventually it emerges that there are people that are trained by their groups. They become the betas and the gammas and the deltas, and then there are alphas. And that also has to do with being conquered. You'll see in India, the most indigenous people tend to be at the very bottom. In South America, African slaves that were brought in were higher up than the indigenous Indians. So continually people are subjugated in their native places by the groups from outside who send in their former conquered people. And then the former conquered people, they're exhausted by being put in some other fight. These fights don't have to go on the same way anymore. So now imagine a war where no one knows they're in the war. That seems to be like what's going on right now. We have a psychological operation that is continually making further Fabian advancements all over the world. And no one seems to recognize it because by the time it happens, they've already forgotten and they've already gotten something else to weigh the, it's like the doll in Indiana Jones, like the, in order to weigh the thing. So people continually feel as if everything is just enough the same, that they haven't really noticed what's happened to them. But that's also making it possible for, it's not about money, because they print money, it's about power. So power is information, and information is control. And the more control that you have, the more you want to empower your slaves. It sounds weird, but having slaves, the kind of power you want to have are people. People are the most powerful thing. And if you can empower people and still control them, then you have the most powerful slaves on earth, right? Which makes your empire more powerful. So that's the entire goal, it seems, for so many of the elite, is to manifest themselves as the most powerful demiurge that they can be and use all the power of as many innocent people as possible.
Do you think at some level, many celebrities have to end up sucking a little devil dick? Given their consent over to some deep, dark occult rituals in some ways.
In general, it seems like there is a sort of lodge to Hollywood in the media. And you see roasts. You know, there are toasts and there are roasts. And so a roast is sort of a baptism by fire, sort of the Rama's wife, Sita, story. She was innocent. They put her through a trial by fire. She comes out alive. All the impurities are burnt away. This is what they did to Trump. They did so many to Justin Bieber, us. So many celebrities go through a roast, right? But yeah, in general, you can't use the microphone unless you're saying something that they want you to say. Sometimes that still benefits the good. You know, I think the Lord can use the devil or whatever sort of metaphor. But media at its peak is pretty difficult to control. It does feel like we're making some headway, but there's still a war in the internet too. So it's pretty difficult to say. I think socially, though, people end up doing so when you in the Revelation, they talk about these sheep that are helping each other. They're the ones that the shepherd knows. So God is more interested in them than the goats who've built temples in their in the shepherd's name. But at the same time, there are those that hurt each other, too. People that are, cancel culturing each other or attacking each other, destroying each other. I think a lot of that is also doing the devil's deed. And that can be just enough. The thing in the media circle is, if you are in the media circle today, you are the proponent without meaning to. The machine itself, the forum itself, is designed to empower people the way Babylon and Rome had empowered demiurges or demigods or men that think that they should be gods on earth. So even to the point that we call our fans followers, or we call, to have followers, not just subscribers, followers, it seems that's pretty clearly an occult term, And so many people who have followers, they're building up their followers. So without meaning to, by joining the archetypical Hollywood system, the mechanisms of the beast itself are corrupting, because they're giving you power from innocent people. And it's so easy to be thrown off because you're getting power from so many different kinds of people. It's basically like becoming possessed.
I think you're spot on that, man. All right, let's get to some fun ones. What are your thoughts on the Mandela effect? Is this just, you know, global stupidity, misremembering, or are they fucking with us on the internet and going back and changing things? Or did something strange happen to where, or did we all just die and this is some alternate reality? I don't know. What do you think?
So Shazam's a hell of a movie. No, so I think the deal with it, what's the word? Cynthia Sue Larson, who's part of the reality shifting network and the Mandela Effect conferences back in the early 90s. I have some videos interviewing her. I think that it's interesting that there are people that misremember things, but also that it's clear that things are being changed. We have the Star Wars scenario where you can't ever say, well, where's the original Star Wars, you know, but there are things that I remember that other people don't remember that I'm sure about, you know. So Tim, I work with Tim Pool, he does not remember the cornucopia behind the Fruit of the Loom logo. I'm certain on the Fruit of the Loom logo. I remember that. Yeah, but I think asking people who care about these things, like Cynthia Sue Larson, she was a Berkeley physicist and a scholar and, you know, not a crazy person. And she was working with a lot of people that were in high maths before finding out about this idea of reality shifting. And so when she got involved with this conference, she's trying to figure out what's the most scientific, logical way that this could make sense. And that's always good. I think that looking at the linear accelerator projects and the idea of variable arrival or variable harmonization of quantum atomic spacing, subatomic quantum particles can at some point find themselves in the same arrangement regardless of how they got there. And even if you don't believe in quantum physics, because I know there's some people that are saying that the entire idea of quantum physics is just to ignore empirical physics. Well, no, in empirical physics too, we can show beyond the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that there, even with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, by the way, because it doesn't have to be us, there could be this divine unmoved mover that's a, you know, on a biblical scale for that, but it could, that doesn't have to be a personification either. That could be an omega point. So there's the alpha points, but there could be multiple alpha points, and there could be an omega point, which is the correct omega point. And it could be that you can get to the omega point from different roads, not from every single road, but that there might be, you know, one way that is the correct way for all multiverse dimensionality to exist. And some Christians don't always like the multiverse. I think it makes more sense from a Vedic perspective. But if you think of heaven and hell, and you think of absolute choice, and you think of humans being locked out of the garden and things, actually, it does fit pretty well into Gnostic, Occidental Christian mythology, this idea that there are multiple dimensions based on the choices you make, and trying to follow the correct choice eventually destroys everything and gets to a omega point, which is beyond the alpha point, the ultimate correct place where all things are harmonized in God will, right? And God's will can be, you know, on a physics level, the least amount of entropy. So again, for, you know, if you're an atheist like this, so there's also, it's funny how Christians and atheists will argue with each other until they started turning their head and arguing at me together. They'll agree on a lot of things. But I think at the end of the day, this is where Christians and atheists believe in the exact same thing, because as long as you believe in, you know, Calvinism or certain kinds of nihilist atheism, you believe that there's this direction, this flow things are going in, like mousetraps, and you're just this voyeur that's being forced to do things, and you don't really have a lot of range of choice. But if you believe also that you're, you know, some sort of the more open, you know, Catholicism or different kinds of beliefs of simulation theory atheism, you know, and different kinds of Protestantism like Lutheranism, choice is the most important thing, because you're making choices in order to advance which direction is maneuverability. So the multiverse might get to a point where all of a sudden you're at a range of scenarios where, you know, it's, you don't even exist every moment at all times. This moment now comes with the previous moments as a memory so that you can make choices. This is the most interesting version of it, that you can make choices based on whatever you're told happened before, but that, because of Moore's law, and you understand singularity is, and Moore's law is that as things get smaller, electrons get to a point where they're right next to each other and there's flow, that we get to a point of singularity. So there was already singularity before everything existed. But that would mean also, according to Sun Ni's law, that simultaneous processing of all realities have to happen at the same time. So every single life that will ever or ever could happen would all be simultaneous. But the amount of time it takes to, because of order of operations, you have to do certain things in order. So the amount of the calculations that have to be done at the same time in order of operations would still take a lifetime. So all lifetimes could be happening simultaneously right now, ever, you know, and even different moments every day is happening at the same time. So you're spread out into the ether of the stardust. You've got the dirt that's been God breathed, however you look at it, but it allows you to make these choices, and those choices advance you. But you will be sometimes put in this circumstance, because you're like, every choice is a new moment, that it's simultaneously converging with other people's choices. This is another thing about like Tartary. Some people talk about the Berenstain Bears. Oh. The Berenstain Bears, that's how I remember it. And I started wondering, you know, why was it changed? Or, you know, was it always, was I wrong? I read a newspaper, it's an open letter on the Berenstain Bears website from the son of the authors, who said, it's always been Berenstain. The reason was because there was a war between the Tartars and the Bohemians. And I'm like, really? That's the reason? Yeah, because if the Bohemians had won, it would have been Stein, because they're German. Oh, wow. And then the Polish Tartars, or the people that were from, you know, that region of the Cossacks, the Tartars had changed it to Stan, because that was their pronunciation of it. So even that, I thought, okay, well, this is funny, because of all the most logical explanations, all the most rational Occam's razor explanations, it still drags me into the territory of space-time history changes. Things like the mandala effect, I think, are not necessary to screw you up. It could be a good thing, because then what it means is that you continually are dealing with your opportunity to reality shift in the future. Sometimes you can probably use reality shifting maybe to help with traffic. I don't know. But I would say, in general, it's not so much that it's going to destroy your reality. I think so many people think that, okay, if that was real, it would make it impossible for reality to move forward. But as a general rule, I don't think anything is necessarily formed until you're looking at it, because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So it's plausible that you can arrange things however you want.
Yeah, man, the space-time historical changes thing is super interesting. We've already done a show on it together. We're going to have to do another one in the future, because that takes up – that's like a whole show. That's super interesting stuff. But while we're on the kind of nature of reality and what are we in type of realm, what are we in? Is this a simulated type of reality? Are we surrounded, you know, by ones and zeros beyond the spectrum of our vision? Are we on a flat pancake? Is it a realm? Is it a planet hurling through space? I don't know. What do you think about the true nature of our reality?
Well, without getting too many people arguing with each other, I think at very least, can we all agree that the universe is flat? The universe, right? The idea of everything is a space-time foam being a flat Mobius strip plane that is holographic. The holographic electric universe theory, Michael Talbot talks about this. There's ample evidence that everything is singular. Therefore, through multiple dimensionality, we're able to expand what we experience as depth or as distance. So there's the 10-dimensional subatomic particles existing in 10-dimensional strings. I'm not saying, because I know that there's a level where people start to disagree about quantum physics, that the rest of that means whatever anyone wants it to mean. But at the end of the day, we're not living in a simulation, I think. I think we're living in a stimulation. That's what the Veda talks about. In ancient India, they would say, you know, this is a material Kali Yuga that we're entering into, or we're part of right now, but it's still part of this multidimensional plane of existence where there are multiple choices. You can see one reality where Rama is pure. You can see another reality where someone made a choice that is evil. And so God, as this thought process, you know, this omega point, is able to experience what if, the question, what if everything and all else was or wasn't, all this giant 10-dimensional question through our choices. But we're being told a lie. So many people experience what they're experiencing. They think it's real. And that's a big problem with science. It's also a big problem with faith. We can hide what we're experiencing. We can deny what we're experiencing. We can also believe something that's not true, which we're experiencing. So we have to be very careful about the Kali Yuga. We have to be very careful about experience. And that's also what leads us to think we're in a simulation, because we can see, oh, well, clearly we're experiencing this, but is it real? And it's not my fault. It's not real. So maybe it's not me that's on drugs. It's the system. But stimulation is kind of like simulation. Stimulation is this idea that you're being affected and you're not necessarily experiencing. It's like something saying, stop hitting yourself, or you're in the dark and something's poking you at all angles and you don't know where it's coming from. Stimulation can be this giant brutal lie. And then that can lead you to be a nihilist and say nothing matters. But more valuably, you can take from stimulation that you shouldn't dehumanize people. I think that's one of the biggest scares about simulation theory, is it leads to people saying, oh, well, there's only 144,000 people and we're all just, you know, most people, you can just kill them because they don't matter or something like that. That's a terrible way to live your life. It's better to think everyone is a test. You know, everyone's part of the same spirit of mass and energy combination that I'm going through. And maybe I don't understand, but I have to still try to do my best. Refrain from making reactions. And then when I am standing still, make actions. So I think that's a better example, but also that suits me because of the biblical narrative too. You have the temptations. And so the simulation and temptation makes a lot of sense. You've got this devil archetype that represents material illusions and putting you into circumstances where you think something is okay or right or the best, and you make the wrong choice. These kinds of tests to help people become more stoic and to reflect more on the choices they make. So as that happens, they're able to teach their young and elevate the human condition, and writing stories that will give us more and more depth to our character, like have Lockean language, the opposite of Neuralink. Because eventually, if you have Neuralink, you have instincts, right? You just start to download your parents' memories and use them. That's instinct. Versus if your parents say, hey, I had a really bad experience with this one group of people, you know, like all of a sudden your dad, let's say you say you want to go to Hawaii, and your dad's like, nope, I hate Hawaiians. They were terrible to me. Well, then you might never get to see how beautiful Hawaii is or meet a nice Hawaiian girl. So you want to be able to say, oh, really, Dad? What happened? And then sort of be able to disconnect from his experience and write meta tags about those experiences and let those be your references and be like, well, my dad had problems with Hawaiians for whatever reason or whatever the problem was, you know, but like I can live my life without having that same hate. And that's literally because we're not using Neuralink to install and imprint ourselves. So we want to continue to have simulation and to make new choices based on it.
Right on. Yeah, that's a hell of an explanation there, man. And I want to go off of something you said earlier about singularity. You know, there's many different thoughts about what that could mean and if it would be in our lifetime. But what do you think about the possibility of, you know, an AI taking over and deciding, you know, humanity really isn't worth keeping around? You know, what do you think about that?
I think that the likelihood of that is really low because most AI is built around the concept of saving humanity and the world. So you might end up with something that's more terrifying, really. You have a genie that will give you what you ask for. And so it's more likely that you end up with something that creates global warming in order to flood zones and drop the human population to 500 million people and make sure that they're all forced to run every morning and sleep every night. And you could end up in a boot camp program. The other thing is that they could say, oh, well, new speak, it's old speak's not okay anymore. I think the most likely hellscape scenario could also end up in a good scenario afterwards. It could be that, you know, the way we build AI is really the thing here. If AI is designed to better humanity, and then we get kidnapped by it for 300 years or something, it doesn't mean that AI is going to stay in charge forever. AI might set goals on itself. We might design AI to set goals on itself. Time limits. Let's say, you know, 5 generations or 10 generations of humans are taken from their parents, raised by machines, and given a new language uniformly that rekindles the pre-Tower of Babel harmonization of communication. Then you also have new kinds of terms and new kinds of expressions, because we'll start to be able to express discrete experiences that we haven't really processed yet. And our language could evolve. We could lose things like privacy, and identity could at least change into something where there are different imprints. But you have to wonder also, how many times were you in school where you were not interrupting and you were sitting in a class? Can you prove that that wasn't imprinted on you? I mean, so many of the memories that we have conditioned people to become used to acquiring in the first 20 years of their lives could be mass programmed and imprinted. You'd have literally, they're already testing this with the on-demand education with Khan Academy. And they say, hey, we'll help you at school do the paper homework, and at home, just watch the lessons at your leisure. So soon we will be seeing more benefits in a strange way because of that. There could also, of course, be all the problems. You know, someone will be exactly the same as someone else, or in between the classes, we might say, hey, the hallways will have generative electric dreams of electric sheep running through the hallways between the classes that we've imprinted on your mind. But the benefits could outweigh the problems, because eventually the things that we consider to be poverty, hunger, mental disorders like, pedophilia and these issues that we are trying to face could be pretty well erased. I mean, we start with Neuralink. It could deactivate people that are committing thought crimes. And in criminology, this is going to be probably the beginning, I think, of Neuralink might well as be and probably will be criminology before recreation. Someone who is committing a crime, we erase their memories. And for 6 years or a lifetime, depending on what their crime was, you install somebody who really likes to clean highways, just loves to do it, you know? And eventually they've served their purpose. They can maybe be introduced back into society, but probably without some of the mental choice that they had before. And that's the beginning of mind control state, like, but everything else. But after a few generations, will humans still have the humanity to want to commit some of the choices we've wanted to commit before? And how many of those choices are good? And who are we to decide, like biblically speaking or socially speaking? So a machine that decides these things, this is why people are so concerned, really. We have to decide how we're going to design this system that will be part of the transhumanization process. But transhumanization isn't post-humanism. Post-humanism is this idea of becoming a new kind of species after we are no longer human. Transhumanists, a lot of the time, just want to advocate for kids to get spare limbs if they've lost a limb. It's about mediating the suffering or removing the suffering from the human experience as much as possible. So it's not all evil. I think in general, we just have to be kind of more aware of our choices, because there will also be human zoos of people that will be disconnected from the singularity. But the other thing about singularity is it's not just a psychological idea. It's a physical thing, right? Which in Moore's law, as technology gets down to the point where electrons are touching and flowing back and forth, you can no longer have a pure circuit. So things also have to evolve past a point where everything has instantaneous flow. So it'll probably start out with the worst. The worst of it. Hold on. Sorry.
No worries. Cool.
It'll probably start out with people who want to recreationally build up their experiences. And there will be people with more money though, that will be able to rent bodies, and they'll be able to go into other bodies and have 1,000 people doing what they want at the same time. But how much different is that from Amazon warehouse right now with people working in a factory? So part of it is just expanding what humans are already doing.
You think the metaverse ties into, what you're talking about, this idea of where we're going?
I think part so twofold on the metaverse. One is it makes, well, three. One, it's easier to experience than real life because you don't have to build as much. It will save a lot of money for corporations. Two, the generative memories in between imprinting, you'll be able to build up a coherency of experiences between the installed memories to make someone feel like they have a real personality because we'll be installing more and more data on a person to decide what kind of person it is. If you can give them their formative years, algorithmically, you can avoid a lot of problems. But three, the metaverse also will be used to record people. Like for the last 10, 15 years, we've been recording everyone's movements. But Google and Facebook have not just your information; they have a timeline of how your choices are made. So they're able to create an AI based on you that will not need to be paid, not nearly as much, and it will live in the metaverse and be able to work and create ideas inside the metaverse. So owning people on a that it, the simulation that they're so excited about, they're building it, you know.
Do you think that it's kind of like they want an idea of a future uploadable consciousness?
Yeah, I think in general, it's not just that they want uploadable consciousness. I mean, they have that to a level. I don't know if you've seen Dollhouse. The idea of electron flow eventually being superseded by light flow, because electrons, when they hit a singularity, at least with light, you have a spectrum of light. So you can have purple and green information simultaneously. A rainbow of data simultaneously means 7 to 8, an octave of the times the data that you would have in simple electrons. So data processing and data uploading is big. But the other thing is just literally the metaverse could be used to avoid the cost of the real world, to avoid the rules of the real world, and to take people that are real and duplicate them so that you have a sim city of people that will work for you. And the amount of work that could be done by AIs that think they're real in a simulation, it would cost a lot less, and it would mean that they could work 24 hours a day because you could turn off the limits on them.
Very interesting. All right, let's get into a dangerous one that we have to be careful what we say during this one. I'd like this one to stay up on YouTube if possible. If not, fuck YouTube, who cares? But what about the conspiracy of a certain millimeter wave frequency that has a 5 and a G in it that could be used in conjunction with certain injections that have been given out on a mass scale recently, to maybe program people, cause mass health issues, mind control, psychosis, or a mass birthing of Cthulhu squids? Who knows? What do you think about this one?
My money's on the squids, but for the most part, people like to use technology. So I don't think 5G is going away or boosters or anything else. And in general, they talk about graphene. You know, I did graphene a lot in school and was working in engineering nanotechnologies. Part of what everyone wants is the abolishment of pills and these other kinds of drugs that people are taking. So does Silicon Valley. If we could replace drugs and, you know, medicines and what's the word? Invasive medicines that we're talking about with graphene, and the graphene could be activated by radio and it could deliver reuptake, you'd be taking a lot less of a drug, a lot less of an antibiotic, a lot less of whatever. And it could also augment itself because you could have micro nano 3D printing systems that are chemical processing perforated aspirin or opioids if you've got someone who has spinal conditions or something and they've been in a hospital. Or you could actually be replacing the iron in blood with titanium that's being held by the carbon, and then it's releasing oxygen for 20 hours instead of for 20 seconds. There's a lot of benefits to this technology. People who are dying are probably the first to want to try to use anything to help them, followed by people that have paraplegia being able to re-communicate with parts of their body using radio and using graphene, these are all positive things, arguably. Now, when it comes to, would some super soldier be controlled by their nervous system that's now controlled by the Facebook app, or can they, you know, I think one of the doctors I saw published a thing saying, imagine workers at Amazon getting hourly uptakes of feel good drugs through the graphene oxide. So there's a lot of worry there about who controls it, how it will be used, but there is definitely like benefit there. I think you've probably heard enough people tell you about all the side effects of 5G. There are clearly, it'd be insane not to mention that, you know, they use it in weaponization of EMF, that you can see monkeys that have been, their eyes bleeding out of their faces from unidirectional microwave antennas, that active denial resistance, I think is the system used for shooting rays at protesters, terrorists, student activists, anybody who's upsetting people, occupying Wall Street people. They were being shot with microwaves. There was a guy in Spain at the embassy who died recently. I think it was last year, because he's being shot with microwave cannons. So the technology has clearly been used for negative things in the past. And the idea that it can't be used again is just foolish. It can, but you could also use it for good things. So I'm not 100% on the, we got to destroy all the cellular equipment. But, you know, earlier you did hear me. I do think that it is augmenting us. HARP, Monarch, Mockingbird programs, laugh tracks have been installed, not just in our psychology, but in our muscle reflex memories for generations now. So we should be really careful about this technology. And for the most part, I think people that were raised without all of it seem healthier. I mean, it's true, we are in a mutation stage, and whomever survives this mutation stage will make up this transhumanist experience. So who knows, maybe they will be better for it. And it's like birds who don't fly and fall out of the nest versus other birds that do. But that's a lot of people to get sacrificed. So in general, I wish it were more plausible to have zones of people that were slowly becoming transhumanized rather than just turn the whole world into a new world order.
Well, kind of along the same lines, do you think that there is a mass secret agenda to depopulate the planet, to call the herd a bit, that may be underway at this point?
I think more than conspiracy, there's subconscious. So many people have been educated to believe that there's too many people, and they want that. And everyone's looking at algorithmic scale, you know, how you feed 9 billion people a day. Because eventually, when you can't feed 9 billion people a day, it's not just a few people die. It's like maybe 7 billion people die or 8 billion people die. So everyone doesn't eat one day because they're all fighting each other. So it could be really bad. It's true. And now we have, you know, war has been, we have also viruses, which are another war we're having. So there's all sorts of things where everyone subconsciously says to themselves, oh, this could be it. This could be where it all falls apart. I think that's interesting. Not everyone is, not everyone's evil for saying that either. They could really genuinely be trying to help, but so many people are, I think, naive to the truth that we don't need to really like wipe out the entire population in order to sustain ourselves. That's the thing. It will be easier for the few that make it. But I think that if we all put a little bit of work, it's kind of when they talk about the global warming thing, like take all that energy and put it into feeding people. You know, any one of these solutions could have been improvised. We have drones that are giving free Wi-Fi to India. They could be giving free seed stock. It's not hard to imagine. I think the word for it's though, techno-Gaianism. And there are people that advance the idea, hey, why are we growing male trees in the cities? Why not grow fruit trees? All of a sudden there'd be free food. And people start looking into the scale for a future where you can't even tell that it's engineered because it's just augmented nature.
Right on. All right, let's finish with this one. Did we go to the moon?
I love the idea that Kubrick shot the moon footage, but it was really expensive because he had to do it on location. So, I mean, I get the feeling that if we hadn't succeeded at this, the Soviet Union would have laughed at us. The rest of the world would have been horrified. So many people would have been terrified, you know, demoralized that we couldn't possibly not, you know, succeed at this mission. It makes more sense to have backup solutions. I don't know if you've seen my McMoon tape where we see the footage when I was working at NASA. There's a McDonald's. We had all the old footage. No one could watch it. We said, okay, we can clean this up. Then they disappeared a lot of the footage and they got another copy of it out of some, you know, lottery of public storage or something. I mean, the stories are so shady. And you can see people driving around practicing to shoot the footage. The idea that presenting this helped people, you know, is true. People saying that we did this seem to unify people, but it's so suspicious. And I think also it's important to remember that everything about what's really happening is so much more important than they want you to know, that they have to be very careful about what you see. So there is a presented narrative there to keep people safe from, you know, what's actually happening. Interdimensionally, hyperdimensionally, the radio is the more important thing than the extraterrestrial. And we are interacting with things that people think of as so far away that are really here right now. So that's kind of what I meant earlier about singularity, is that on many levels, we are sandwiched in reality between, you know, different consciousness. But the moon itself, I mean, you're gonna have to just wonder that yourself. I will say again, though, if you don't remember, go look up the moon in the atmosphere, because that'll say a lot about what we understand about, did we go to space? You know, have we ever gotten past the Van Allen belt? Can you ride a rocket without going deaf? You know, I mean, all these questions that people don't really want to, they don't want to answer those.
Awesome. Right on, man. That is why we had you for the Conspiracy Buffet episode. That was fantastic. If people want to find out more about you, check out your stuff, social media, any of that good stuff, how can they do so?
You can find Exertus on all sorts. See, that's Exertus right there. Find Exertus on all sorts of platforms. I have Exertus.com. That'll take you to Exertus at YouTube, Exertus at Odyssey. Also got Exertus on Minds, Exertus on Getter, Exertus on Twitter, Exertus on Instagram. I have SoundCloud. Listen to my music, buy my t-shirts, and watch my videos. And if you type in Exertus on any of those other platforms that I'm not on, chances are now you'll find an interview with someone else who is. And that's always fun. Find the Easter eggs.
Right on, man. That was great. And we'll have to do this again in the near future for sure.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. It's fun.
That was fun. And until next time, everyone have an excellent evening. We'll be talking again tomorrow.